From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. As 2016 comes to a close, what international story stands out above all others? Razia Iqbal is the host of the NewsHour on the BBC World Service, and I asked her what she thought the top story of the year was.
For many people, it has been an unprecedented year. There have been so many big stories, but I suppose if you had to come down with one in particular, the poll-defying election of Donald Trump has to be it, not least because it did surprise so many people, but also because of its ramifications and the impact that that particular event is going to have in the next 4 years. So I guess that would be it. But there are many, many other huge stories that have impacts both in their own specific regions, but also for the wider region. For example, the way in which Turkey has played out in the Middle East, the way in which there's a resurgent Russia and how that's playing out, not just in Ukraine and Crimea, but in the Middle East. I could go on.
Right. And in fact, those two things I will want to speak with you in greater detail. But let's just stick with Trump here for just a second, because I would love to hear from you the global perspective following November 8th. How did news that Trump was going to be the president-elect of the United States, how did that reverberate in the UK?
Well, I think people in the United Kingdom were probably as surprised as those who are following it in the United States. I think the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win it, even though the polls had been close pretty much throughout the entire second year of the campaign. I mean, I think one of the things that is surprising for many people around the world is how long the US presidential campaign is. I mean, it's virtually a full 2 years. And I rocked up in Iowa and New Hampshire at the beginning of 2016, and I went back to the United States and to Utah, of all places. And we had lots of our teams covering the election. And we did get a sense that this was clearly the year of the insurgent on the Democratic Party side, Bernie Sanders, and on the Republican side, Donald Trump. I must admit that after I came back from New Hampshire, I did feel that it was possible he could win the nomination. At which point people were saying, oh, don't be so ridiculous. He's a joke. And the only reason I thought it was not because I was more prescient than everybody else, far, far from it. I just went to two of his rallies and I was so struck by the contrast between his rallies and the hustings that Hillary Clinton was showing up for. It was just a completely different atmosphere.
Passion,
commitment, a curiosity about whether this man could run the country in the way that all the people who turned up at his rallies were convinced that he had run his businesses. So even if you said to them, as journalists often did, well, you know, he did have to make himself bankrupt, even if he didn't individually, personally make himself bankrupt, his businesses didn't always succeed. Besides which, a country is not the same as a business.
Right.
It really went to the heart of, I think, what for many outsiders, you could argue, is the kernel of truth in the United States, which is that it's an entrepreneurial country. Mm. It's a country that is absolutely built on a desire for capitalism to succeed. And people believe in the individual to be able to do that. And I think Donald Trump really tapped into that.
Well, he famously called himself before the election Mr. Brexit. And at the time, some people were confused about what he meant. Other people fully understood it. I mean, because he was obviously referencing the equally surprising Brexit vote that had happened earlier in the year. And so I want to talk with you about that here for just a moment. But let's play some tape to sort of give people a sense as to how surprising and even divisive the Brexit vote was in the UK. We've got some tape here from NPR's Frank Langfitt. He spoke to voters in London shortly after the Brexit vote. Here's Sue Coburn. She's a woman in her 50s who voted for Britain to leave the EU.
I feel absolutely fantastic, completely liberated, and this is the best thing that's happened to our country for many years.
Well, and then we also have some tape from 20-year-old student Ellie Walker. She thinks many people, older people, voted to leave the EU because they're uncomfortable, in Ellie's view, with ethnic differences.
And that's just because they come from a different time. So they're, like, buying into all of that propaganda about the immigrants and about how, like, if we can get them to leave, it's all going to be better.
the Brexit vote sort of it definitely presaged the U.S. presidential election, but it's the thing I think that really woke people up in terms of grievances, frustration with government. I mean, how is that all still reverberating in the U.K.?
Well, I think it still is very much reverberating, not least because you could argue that the referendum was a decisive event. And of course it was. The people spoke and, you know, 17 million plus voted to leave the European Union and 16 million or so voted to remain inside the European Union. So you could argue that that decision in and of itself was a clear decision. But actually, the debate that has been taking place since June the 24th tells you quite a lot about the way in which that referendum was shaped, the debate around it. It was one of the most divisive campaigns I've ever seen. I've lived in the United Kingdom for more than 40 years. I wasn't born here, but I was largely educated here, and I was shocked. I was really shocked at the way in which, how nasty it was. I think it is very, very hard not to talk about it as being really unpleasant. The public discourse was unpleasant. There were lies being bandied. People were nasty to each other. There wasn't the kind of respect that one would expect in a very, very serious political debate. And I think it shifted the public discourse in this country about politics and about our place in the world. I think it was very much to do with grievances, but I think perceived grievances on both sides. I think it's a very interesting idea, this notion that somehow there are groups of people who say we are being told what to do by Brussels, and other people saying, no, we're not. We want to be part of a bigger continent. We want the expansive, more comprehensive horizons that the European Union gives us. And the other side saying, do you know what? I don't like outsiders. Mm-hmm. And not being able to locate themselves in a history of an island that has historically welcomed outsiders. There's been tension, no question. I come from an immigrant family. I came to this country from East Africa by way of India, Pakistan, and then East Africa. So I understand the potential for hostility and tension and so on. But that exists in the United States too. And it was very interesting to hear people, both in Iowa and New Hampshire, which was my first encounter with the presidential campaign, people constantly referring to Brexit, saying, well, you know, it could happen here. You guys, you know, are in the middle of this really interesting campaign. By the time I got to Utah in the summer, everyone was referring to Brexit. Huh. As being the kind of almost the bellwether permission that was being given to people to say, we're fed up with the way things are done now.
Now, these questions matter even more, given what you had talked about in the very beginning of our conversation, which is, you know, how Russia is now making a bigger presence on the international stage. So talk to me about Russia and its role in 2016.
I think it's been very interesting. It's almost as though the United States blinked and Russia stepped in. When President Obama made the decision to draw a red line in the sand over Syria back in 2013, and didn't do anything about the evidence that suggested that chemical weapons were being used in Syria, it was almost as though a decision has been made to step back away from getting the United States involved in yet another Middle Eastern quagmire. So that was a conscious decision, it felt like, to the rest of the world. The vacuum left in the Middle East by the United States resulted in President Putin being given an opportunity to step in, and it changed everything on the ground. Mm. And so there is a sense that there is a resurgent Russia now that feels very buoyed and confident and ebullient as a result of the battle it feels it's fighting in the Middle East against what it sees as terrorists. So they don't see this as a battle for the democratic forces inside Russia, which is, we should remind people, that this is how the civil war began. A group of students, young people, demonstrating on the streets of a country that is had up until that point been incredibly authoritarian. They were fighting for democracy. It, of course, morphed into many, many different things. And it's a very complicated conflict on the ground, which results in the United States and the coalition in the West supporting groups on the ground that are affiliated with al-Qaeda.
Right.
That's how complicated the conflict on the ground is. And so, in a way, it's been very, very fortuitous for Russia to step in and say, this is our battle against terrorism, and that's what they're doing. And I think that makes it very makes everything very interesting now, because President-elect Donald Trump has made no secret of the fact that he admires President Putin. So what could be regarded as an age-old conflict between Russia and the United States could be rewriting itself even as we speak.
Well, Razia Iqbal hosts the BBC NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Razia, thank you so very much and best wishes for the new year.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been great being with you. Thank you.
Amtrak currently operates more than 300 trains daily, carrying more than 30 million passengers a year, and the railroad is hoping to make progress on some major projects and overdue improvements. So with the next president's talk about infrastructure investment, could the next few years be a boon for Amtrak, a federally subsidized company that has never turned a profit? Well, in September, Charles Wick Moorman took over as president and CEO of Amtrak. Prior to that, he spent 40 years at the freight train operator Norfolk Southern, one of the country's largest transportation companies. And he joins us now. Wick Moorman, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, first of all, I want to get a sense from you about how important you believe this moment is for Amtrak, because we have an incoming administration with Donald Trump that's pledged to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Do you believe that Amtrak could be a part of that?
Well, I certainly believe that Amtrak could be a part of it and should be a part of it as we move more and more into a world where there are more and more people who think that train travel is a desirable alternative. And I think the president-elect certainly understands the importance of Amtrak, coming from New York as he does. And I also believe that the critical Amtrak projects, and in particular the so-called Gateway Project, which involves access into New York City, is something that he understands the importance of.
Have you had a chance to speak with the president-elect?
I have not. We have spoken with members of his transition team.
And what were those conversations like?
Well, those conversations were really talking about the importance of Amtrak in general, but then the importance of investing in an infrastructure that's absolutely critical to the economy of the Northeast and in many cases is 80 to 110 years old.
Mm. So tell me more about that. In the coming year, in an ideal world, where would you focus Amtrak's efforts in terms of infrastructure, expansion? What are your top priorities?
Well, our top priorities in the Northeast Corridor are clearly the replacement of this critical infrastructure. If you look across the broader Amtrak network, we have an aging car fleet and an aging diesel locomotive fleet, and they clearly need to be not only kept in good repair, which we do, but ultimately replaced. And that's significant capital funding. But while I talk about that, let me also just mention the very good news. And that is that Amtrak has secured funding for the next generation of high-speed trains on the corridor, the Acela replacements. And that contract has been let, and work is underway on those trains, and we will be getting delivery of those in about 4 to 5 years.
Hmm.
We've also replaced our electric locomotive fleet on the corridor, which was a significant step forward in terms of reliability.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned the Northeast Corridor, and you also mentioned a little earlier in our conversation that for many people, train travel is growing in importance as an option. But I wonder what you see as the major obstacles in the way of truly expanding rail travel as a viable means of moving around for folks. And here's why I ask, because, for example, in the Northeast Corridor, an Amtrak ticket from Boston to New York can cost a couple of $100s. And depending on what time of year you're traveling, you can get an airplane ticket for far less than that. So you still have a big price differential there for the same distance covered.
Well, you have a big price differential when you look at the cost of the ticket alone. But when you consider the fact that instead of going to Boston South Station in the middle of town, you've got to make your way to Logan Airport. And then once you arrive in Washington, you have to make your way in from National or Dulles. From a time standpoint, we're very competitive. And from a cost standpoint, we're much more competitive. And that's why when you look at travel in the Northeast Corridor, be it Boston to New York or Washington to New York, Amtrak has the dominant market share. We're the convenient, comfortable way to go. And as we like to say, you don't have to take your shoes off. And there is no middle seat.
Well, you know, we have been focusing a lot on the Northeast here, but of course, it's a really big country. A long time ago, there was conversation, at least at one point in time, about, you know, having high-speed rail on the West Coast. And Amtrak does serve other parts of the country, too. I mean, tell me about the national picture overall. Where would you like to see Amtrak expand or focus?
Well, that's a great question. And there are really two lines of business that we have across the rest of the country. We operate about 15 long-distance routes. Those routes link major cities together and also provide a lot of transportation alternatives to people in underserved areas. And so our goal with the long-distance train service is to try to improve the product and bring more people to the train. Having said that, it's not an area where right now we anticipate a lot of growth. Where we do anticipate growth is in the so-called state-supported services. And these range from a very extensive network in California and then go from Maine to Virginia to Illinois. I think we have 20-some states now. And those are the places where states come forward and say, we'd like to run passenger train service over a shorter distance and quite often into highly congested major urban areas where you really don't want to drive. Mm-hmm. And I see that as a big area for Amtrak's growth in the future.
So, Mr. Moorman, if we can, at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned that you spent 40 years at the freight train operator Norfolk Southern, right?
Well, you know, 40 years, 40 eons, 40. I'm a long time freight railroad person, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, just tell me, what was that like and how does that differ from, you know, obviously the passenger rail services that Amtrak provides?
Well, they're very different in some ways and they're very much the same in others. Clearly, hauling people is a lot different than hauling containers or automobiles or coal. And the customer requirements are clearly different as well. But at the end of the day, the things that it takes to run a good freight railroad are, by and large, the things that it takes to run a good passenger railroad. And so as I've stepped into this role and looked around, I've been able to bring a lot of my experience and actually have brought a few folks in to help me look and see where we can improve the railroading side of Amtrak.
Mm-hmm. Amtrak, though, is a complicated organization because it does rely on some public funds. It's also not run as an independent private company because it is overseen by Congress. Do you see any particular management challenges there given the actual setup of Amtrak itself?
Well, you're exactly right in that Congress passes a fair number of laws that govern Amtrak, and they tend to, you know, be specific in some areas and what they would like to see and what they wouldn't like to see. But at the end of the day, Amtrak is organized to be run as a for-profit corporation, and our goal is to get there someday. And it may take a long time because passenger railroads in general don't make a lot of money. And I worry less about all of those things than I do about ensuring that Amtrak is a well-led, well-organized, and well-managed company.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, and we were looking at some numbers for fiscal year 2016. Amtrak did seem to post record ticket sales and revenue, but still having that operating loss of $227 million or so. So, as you said, not quite there yet when it comes to being a profitable company. But, Mr. Moorman, that leads me to my last question, because obviously you are a trains guy. You've dedicated your working life to this form of transportation in the United States. Do you ever get frustrated because when we look for true high-speed rail, that's in Europe, it's in Japan, it's in China, other parts of Asia. They're even moving ahead with maglev rail systems in a couple of places. We're not there yet in the United States. And it seems as if for as long as the government doesn't really put its money where its mouth is in terms of developing our train infrastructure, that we may never get there.
You know, I don't get frustrated because I just see so much opportunity in front of us, even without that European, you know, commitment to spend billions and billions of dollars for higher speed trains.
Forgive me for asking this, but how do you see that opportunity there if the investment dollars to build those high speed rail systems isn't forthcoming?
Well, I'll give you a great example. The new Acela replacements we have, which will be capable of higher speeds, and we will have incrementally shorter schedules on the corridor, but they're also a better train. So I think we'll be able to grow substantially just through offering this superior product on the Northeast Corridor. And as you look around, be it the states, be it the corridor, be it even in some instances with long-distance trains, it's not necessarily that important that you have to go fast, fast, fast everywhere. You just have to be reliable, you have to offer a great product, and you have to tell people something I think they're inclined to believe anyway, which is that travel by train is a great way to go.
Well, Wick Moorman took over as president and CEO of Amtrak in September. Mr. Moorman, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Throughout the campaign and through the transition, President-elect Donald Trump has promised to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. He says he'll do that in part by imposing tariffs on goods imported from places like China. Trump also recently picked Peter Navarro, an outspoken China critic, as the head of the new White House National Trade Council, and there's even talk about a looming trade war between the two world powers. But how are companies in China responding to Trump's plans, especially in the manufacturing strongholds like Shenzhen, where workers produce products for Apple and other consumer electronic companies? For more on that, we've got Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Meghna.
So, Jason, just give us the big picture here. Are these major companies in Shenzhen worried, or how are they reacting to what Donald Trump has said?
Meghna, the big picture is in Shenzhen, China, there are now 230,000 workers are making gear for Apple and their global rivals. And the heads of these companies are saying that even if Donald Trump imposes tariffs on Chinese-made goods, as he's threatened to do, it's now so efficient to engineer, produce, and ship electronics from Shenzhen, China, that they can still outcompete the U.S. Now, to be sure, this month, Apple supplier Foxconn said that it may expand operations in the U.S., but it's unclear, you know, what jobs they'd be moving to the U.S. The journal spoke to a finance professor at Peking University, said, if these jobs come back to the U.S., they're going to be for people who manage 1,000 robots in an automated factory. He said it's going to be jobs for computer nerds, not for the people who voted for Mr. Trump.
Now, Jason, this sounds like equal parts truth and bluster from China, because, look, I mean, the president-elect has talked about imposing tariffs, as you mentioned. Certainly those tariffs would have some impact on these Chinese companies. I mean, if not, then why did tariffs even exist as a tool to control or regulate trade?
Well, I mean, we're reporting that, if anything, higher U.S. tariffs would accelerate economic trends already underway. We've spoken with Shenzhen business owners, and they say that, yes, some factories are already leaving, but they're leaving for low-wage provinces in China. They're not going to the U.S. And at the same time, you know, they're going to other countries, you know, like Vietnam. They're going, you know, the wages have risen in certain parts of China so that they're becoming less competitive.
So it sounds like they're not worried about what the president-elect has said. But what about the broader implications of what a Trump administration might mean for relationships between the U.S. and China? I mean, obviously, the economic ties between these two countries are very strong and very important. I mean, could just his overall presidency have an impact on the growth of these Chinese companies?
There doesn't appear to be a lot of concern at this point because it's all sort of hypothetical. unknowns. They can't anticipate really what a trade war would look like, because really no one can. You know, how bad it could potentially get if things really were to be, if relations were to get really ugly between the U.S. and China. But then it would be not just, I mean, they know this, that it wouldn't be just Chinese manufacturers who would be hurt. It would be American consumers who've grown used to very inexpensive electronics coming from China and other countries that would be paying a lot more when they go shopping on Amazon.com or anywhere else.
Mm. Jason Blini is with The Wall Street Journal. It's always great to talk with you, Jason. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we've got a couple of stories that we've got our eye on. The winter storm that swept into the northern Great Plains on Christmas Day has weakened, but travel remains difficult in parts of the Dakotas. Interstate 94, which had been closed for days in North Dakota, has reopened, as did Interstate 90 in South Dakota. But the National Weather Service says some roads are still blocked by drifting snow. The Minot International Airport in North Dakota has also reopened. Departures and arrivals are expected to resume today, but there's still some cancellations, too, and thousands of homes and businesses are still without power in the region. Also, at 4:10 Eastern, President Obama and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will lay a wreath at the memorial that rests above the sunken USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. Although Japanese leaders have visited Pearl Harbor before, Abe will be the first to visit the Arizona Memorial. The Japanese government says Abe will not be apologizing for Japan's attack at Pearl Harbor during World War II. President Obama did not apologize for Hiroshima when he visited Japan in May. Well, in many households around the holidays, there's a whole lot of baking going on, cakes and pies, and of course, cookies. Acclaimed cookbook author Dori Greenspan has a new book out for the cookie monster in all of us. It's more than 500 pages of cookie lore and recipes of every kind of cookie imaginable, from almond crackles to Greek honey dainties to the famous world peace cookies. Greenspan has written 12 cookbooks, including the New York Times bestseller Around My French Table. She wrote Baking with Julia after spending a summer in Julia Child's Kitchen, and writes the Everyday Dori column for The Washington Post. Her latest cookbook is called Dori's Cookies, and when she came into our studios recently, the cookie conversation started the moment she sat down.
You sat me near the ginger molasses cookies. The smell of them is just so wafting over.
We have a multi-talented staff. Not only can they produce radio, but they can make these great cookies, which they made straight out of your cookbook.
And they are so beautiful. It makes me so happy to see them.
Okay, so why don't you... So tell me a little bit more about the double ginger molasses cookie. What's the story there?
So this cookie, the recipe for it was sent to me by my friend Christine. And I made them, and they came out the way ginger snaps always do, kind of flat and crunchy. And they were delicious. They were so delicious that I felt like they disappeared too quickly. And so I redid the recipe to make them in muffin tins so that they would be thicker and chewier and so that the flavor would last longer.
Well, I'm going to reach across the table here.
Here, have one. Oop, you need long arms.
Okay. Banging into the microphone and everything. And oh, they are... so very good. I try not to eat on the radio. It's not very attractive, but these taste so good.
Well, I want you to eat, even if it is radio. So it has fresh ginger. The cookie has fresh ginger and dried ginger and chocolate and a little espresso. It's got a really interesting mix of spices.
So what is it about cookies that seems so elemental, such a primal source of joy? Is it just that they're sweet confections, or is there something more?
No, I think there's really something more. I think some of it has to do with how personal a cookie is. All yours, and you can eat it any way you want. But I also think we grow up on cookies. You know, my mother did not bake, used her oven for a bread box. But my memories are of cookies. And I found a picture of me holding our son at his first birthday party. And he's holding a homemade cookie. Uh-huh. I think, and he says, cookies are memories. And I think they are, because they're, even if they're not homemade, they're something that, a pleasure that we have very, very often. And I think it's always associated with a nice time.
So what's your memory cookie?
My memory cookie, actually, we have the classic jammer here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so this is a cookie that I dreamed. I was in Paris. I was working on the cookie book. And in the middle of the night, I saw a cookie. This doesn't always happen to me. But I saw it fully formed, beautiful, kind of elbowed my husband and said, I dreamed a cookie. He rolled over. But I think he's used to it. But in the morning, I got up and baked this cookie, and it was just as I had dreamed it was. It is nothing like anything that I had as a child.
So the recipe was in your dream, too? Or
everything. Just... everything. Okay. I just saw it. But the cookie is not really a cookie from childhood at all. I'll describe what it is in a second. But it's the butter and jam that reminds me of the Austrian-German cookies that my mother used to buy from a bakery near our house. So this cookie is – it's built also in a muffin tin. It's a vanilla shortbread cookie. It has jam in the center, and it has streusel around the edges. So you get the flakiness of the shortbread and the crunch of the streusel and that wonderful fruity flavor of jam.
Okay, I'm going to give it a try here because it also looks beautiful. It's a very attractive cookie.
It almost looks like a little tart.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was...
Oh. My staff is laughing at me on the other side of the glass. They're crying. These are good, guys. You did a good job.
Wait. And I'm smiling because you bit it and then put your hand to your heart. Actually, the classic jammers are one of my favorites in the book. A little arts and crafts project.
So the book has hundreds of recipes.
170
recipes. It also has tips, baking tips for cookies, which I find really helpful because I, unlike my producers, I am not a champion baker. I've always kind of struggled when it comes to baking. Other kind of cooking I can do because I find doughs to be very temperamental and they don't react well to me. So do you have a good tip or two for cookie baking?
So I made a discovery a few years ago that changed my life. And it has to do with cookies that you roll out and cut, which I think are the cookies that give people the most problems because the dough should be cold and then the cookies should be cut very crisply. So I made this discovery that if you make the dough and roll it out immediately, put it between two pieces of parchment paper or wax paper, it's so easy. The real instructions were make the dough, put it in the refrigerator, and then when it was hard, roll it. Well, you can't roll it when it's hard. It just is impossible. But if you roll it when it's soft, it's totally submissive. It'll do anything you want. And then you chill it. And it makes making cutout cookies such a pleasure. Uh-huh. It's also helpful. Same technique for pie dough and tart dough.
Oh, okay.
Life changer.
Totally. I mean, my husband loves to make mince pies for Christmas, and we have an almond shortbread recipe that we use for the tart part of the mince pie. And I have that problem every time because we've got to chill it. Then I got to beat, and then I'm heating it up as I'm rolling it out, and it's getting
and you're yelling at it.
Yeah,
it's. And you're getting upset. Yep. Changed. This will be a better year, I promise.
We will try that. Okay, I want to ask you about another cookie here before we run out of time. The World Peace Cookie.
Oh, this cookie. So this cookie, it's a chocolate kind of shortbread cookie, kind of chocolate chip cookie. So it has both brown sugar and white sugar and cocoa, chunks of dark chocolate, and fleur de sel, sea salt. And I got this cookie, the recipe for it, from Pierre Hermé, who's a very famous French pastry chef. And he called it the Corova cookie because he had made it for a restaurant in Paris called Corova. And then shortly after I had published the recipe in my book, Paris Sweets, a neighbor of mine said, oh, I love your chocolate cookies, but we don't call them whatever that name is. We call them World Peace Cookies because if everyone in the world had these cookies— peace would reign.
Absolutely.
And they are, I can never get enough of these. I could make these every day and be happy making them. They're slice and bake cookies, so they're real easy.
Yeah, and I mean, look, they've got chocolate, and chocolate, and they just
there's that
fill you with happiness. We have just a few seconds here. Do you think you can just in 10 seconds tell me about cookies and kindness?
It's my sweet revolution. I'm trying to make the world sweeter. People, I would love you to bake cookies and tag them with the hashtag cookies and kindness. You can tag me at Dory Greenspan so I can see what you're doing. And let's just spread joy.
Dory Greenspan, thank you so much for bringing these cookies, for bringing a little world peace and happiness to our table today.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
As 2016 draws to a close, we've been talking about some of the most notable stories of the year. Today, let's look back at a part of the country that spends most of its time thinking about the future, Silicon Valley. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with Ed Lee, managing editor of our weekly tech guide, Recode, about what caught Ed's eye this year.
Top tech story of the year of 2016, what do you say?
Theranos, if I had to pick one. It was a pretty big deal. The startup that promised the idea that they could test blood without drawing much blood.
A drop.
Just a drop. And it turned out that they were nowhere near having that kind of technology. And a lot of investors invested with that idea. And I think that's that sent a strong signal that, you know, you're a startup. You want to get something out there like this. It's good to dream big, certainly, but you can't not deliver, or at least not even come close in this case.
What's so fascinating about Theranos is that the CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, was absolutely a darling of Silicon Valley. She built this $9 billion business, and it just went, it vanished. Just remind us how big of a deal Theranos was when it first started out.
Well, yeah, as you pointed out, she was quite the darling. She epitomized very much the Silicon Valley ethos, or the Silicon Valley sort of operating system, which is you have this great idea, you pitch it, you get a lot of money. And the valuation that she sort of stoked here was very much out of perceived value instead of actual value. And a lot of startups sort of operate that way, but it was sort of the highest flying, at least of this year, in terms of something that kind of came out of nowhere.
And as you say, it highlights some of the dangers of Silicon Valley.
Yes, exactly. I think, so much of Silicon Valley is driven by sort of this idea that, if I can will it, it'll happen. And that's sort of what was going on here. And the naysayers, they were called naysayers when it really was just reporting, right? Hey, we discovered this is actually not true. A lot of people in the Valley still to this day sort of saw that as somehow you're being negative. You're why are you doing that? Yeah. As if it were a choice somehow.
Yeah. Wall Street Journal gets a lot of credit for that.
They absolutely do.
Yeah. Yes. So you've also noticed Russian hacking, which played a role in the U.S. election. Hey, but so did Apple, a company that seems to make the list every year, though, in 2016, you say, for different reasons.
Well, they didn't do much, right? I mean, they, of course, a new phone. It's slightly thinner. A new laptop with what they call a touch bar and a bunch of dongles, which is sort of the inputs, right? They've changed a lot of those sort of little jacks that you're using, but not much else. There was the dust up with the FBI over encryption and releasing information on a phone that belonged to a terrorist attacker.
But the San Bernardino attackers.
San Bernardino attack. I mean, and even there, they didn't, they ultimately didn't comply, that the FBI revoked their request. They found another way in. So there's a lot of standing still, I want to say, from Apple. And I think, you're only going to see more of that going forward in terms of the encryption issue. But in terms of Apple, the company, it hasn't really sort of delivered on the idea that they're going to do big things. Expectations are always high for that company, and that's what's hard for them.
But Apple did take a stand, as you say, against the Department of Justice, which, maybe give it credit for that if you fall on that side of the debate. But it basically said, if we allow the government to get into this phone, it's going to be terrible, not only for us as a company, but for Americans in general, and potentially have vast repercussions down the road. So, but this issue of encryption, do you think it's here to stay?
It is definitely here to stay, and I think we're only going to see more of these issues pop up this coming year and in the future, especially under the Trump administration. What's interesting here, though, is that the San Bernardino case, what that really taught us is that Apple actually had complied with a lot of law enforcement requests in the past and, in fact, did things like open up individual phones for the sake of retrieving information. The fact that the FBI made it a public thing, it made it a PR issue as much as anything else, and Apple had to take a stand and said, no, we are definitely not going to do that. There's going to be more requests like this going forward, whether through court order or just through the Justice Department or the FBI. And, the Silicon Valley companies like Apple, like Facebook, like Google, they're going to have to be much more clear about what their line is.
Well, you mentioned Donald Trump's name, which makes me think of Peter Thiel, of course, the billionaire entrepreneur, co-founder of PayPal, one of the very few people in Silicon Valley who is a Donald Trump supporter. Right. The question I have about Peter Thiel is, does Silicon Valley have something to learn from him?
Well, so in 2016, he won. I mean, if you're looking at the world of Silicon Valley and entrepreneurs and people driving a lot of the business and the ideas and the money out there, Thiel stands alone. I mean, he backed Trump, and now he's more than just someone who picked the winner, so to speak. He's someone who's now part of an advisor to that administration, and probably going forward will have a bigger say over how policy gets rendered and what that might ultimately mean for a lot of these Silicon Valley companies. I think, you know, ultimately the point is, on some level, you know, you have to engage. I don't think a lot of Silicon Valley folks thought that Trump would win, which is why they probably didn't engage. Mm. Thiel won that one. Mm.
Okay, real quick, in just a few words, what do you expect in 2017 to be the big story?
I think, as I said, encryption will certainly be a factor going forward, and a bigger one. Net neutrality being rolled back will be another factor. And then the emergence of artificial intelligence and robotics, I think that's going to only become a bigger story in terms of consumers and how these companies are going to develop this sort of the next iteration of computing.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor of Recode, speaking with our colleague Peter O'Dowd about the top tech stories of 2016. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.